Yes, we've moved room now, and we're.
it's got a lovely view. It's
it smells lovely.
Yeah, it's got a special fragrance, but it's exciting to be in a new room. So it's like guerrilla philosophy. You know, we have to hide, and we're hidden away now. Nobody's listening.
Phenomenological resistance.
Yes, it's the phenomenological resistance. So we're back. So we're still at the very beginning. Husserl's asking this question, well, how are we to study subjectivity? Let's just read his kind of musing on this. If we set up the goal of a truth about the objects, which is unconditionally valid for all subjects, beginning with that on which normal Europeans, normal Hindus, Chinese, etc. agree, in spite of all relativity, beginning, that is, with what makes objects of the life world common to all, identifiable for them and for us, even though conceptions of them may differ, such as spatial shape, motion, sense quality and the like, then we are on the way to objective science. When we set up this objectivity as a goal, the goal of a truth in itself, we make a set of hypotheses through which the pure life world is surpassed. Basically what he's saying is, well, if we want to study the life world of individual people, and we want to make something objective of it, meaning something that's valid and true concerning what subjectivity is, then the first thing that we have to do, if you like, the first one approach is to say, okay, well, let's recognize what all of these life worlds have in common. What is it about all of these life worlds that they would all agree on? You know, like the intersection of the place where we would all say, oh yes, we agree on that. We differ on this, this, this and this, but we agree on that. And he's basically saying, well, actually that's what objective science already does. We agree on the shape of things, we agree on the weight of things, we agree on what we can measure. So that approach to studying subjectivity by saying, okay, let's abstract away all the differences and just look at what is in common, we basically end up with the objective world that science has already investigating. And in doing such, we abstract ourselves entirely away from subjectivity itself. He's saying, well, we've precluded this type of surpassing anyway through the first epoche. And now we have the embarrassment of wondering what else can be undertaken scientifically as something that can be established once and for all and for everyone. So, see, he's got that intent of a universal science still. It's not that we end up, I mean, there's the other way to do it is a kind of, in a way, through literature. You could say literature is a kind of a study of subjectivity, and you could just collect all the great novels of all of the great novelists, and say here is the life worlds on Earth. But there would be no unity in that either. You know, well, that would be one way of studying life worlds, wouldn't it? To actually make a deep and individual study of your life world and my life world and everyone's life world. But Husserl isn't that's not his intent either. Phenomenology is, in a sense, he's still following this idea of that there is going to be some kind of unified science. And if our entire intent is either to become utterly objective or to study subjectivity in its individuality, both directions miss. We miss this this goal of coming to an understanding of subjectivity that is true for everyone. But this embarrassment disappears as soon as we consider that the life world does have, in all its relative features, a general structure. This general structure, to which everything that exists relatively is bound, is not itself relative. We can attend to it in its generality and with sufficient care fix it once and for all in a way equally accessible to all. So he's got this idea that there's something about the way that subjectivity functions. I mean, the thing about subjectivity is that it's able in a way to generate all of these unique life worlds of all of these unique individuals on Earth, but there's something about this capacity to generate life worlds that is the general structure of universal or transcendental subjectivity. It's the capacity to produce all these individual life worlds that Husserl wants to look at. I feel it's going to get hot in here.
Yeah, absolutely.
With the projector. Is that, yeah. It's the opposite of last week now. That's on, yeah, so maybe it's, because pretty soon we'll be, you know, T-shirts. So he's starting to look into, if we look into the life world and we look into the subjectivity that lies behind it, what is this general structure that we can make out? And the first thing he wants to talk about is the world horizon. He's not saying it explicitly as I remember in the text, but he's basically saying so. So all life worlds have a world horizon. This is one of the general features of the life world, which isn't some kind of objectification of things that you can measure. It's not a measurable thing, the idea that there's a horizon. There's something more interesting in the way that phenomenology develops. He calls it the eidetic method, which is basically a way of looking into your own experience and say and confirming what's being said simply by reference to, often by how you can actually vary your own experience to sort of identify within yourself the essential structure of your experience. And this isn't like doing science and doing measurements and doing something objectively outside, because we don't have to observe experience as something separate from ourselves. We actually are this experience. We know it directly. So a lot of phenomenology is a matter of saying, well, can you see or perceive the structure of your own experience? And you don't need to do experiments as if you're studying something outside of you. You can simply say, oh yes, my perception is like that for me, because everything that perception is, you already know about. You may not have recognized it or made it explicit, but you know what perception is because you inhabit it all the time. So an awful lot of phenomenology is a matter of Husserl or I or you simply just describing how it is, and then whoever's there must be a verb that you can make out of co-phenomenologizing, whoever is co-phenomenologizing with you performs the same eidetic variation of their own experience, because it's possible to perceive the essential structure of perception simply by observing your own experience. Not that we're talking about perception yet. We're talking about the world horizon. So what herself is saying is, well, this is how the world horizon is for me, from within my already enacted epoche. One of the things I guess we have to keep recognizing here is that Husserl's already, if you like, withdrawn from his involvement in being in the world and is simply observing from a place of pure witnessing. How does it stand with my experience? Because phenomenology, it's a strange process. It's like you have to, in a way, examine your experience in order to realize that there is something generating that experience, but you can't really examine your experience until you've already abstracted yourself in some sense from it to a place where you can observe it. You know, it's one of those things where the end result of studying experience is that you can in some sense get an overview of what it is, but you can't study it until you're already in the place where you can see it. You know, the two things are, it's not like you do one and then the other. You have to kind of, you're going round. Each time you go round, you say, oh yeah, yeah, I see a bit more. And it's almost like I've pulled back a bit more. So this attempt now is to try and understand what the world is for us. In terms of the horizon of our life world, the tendency for us to think, when we think about the world, is we think something like we think about the objective universe, the earth, the sun, everything on the earth, all the cities, all the countries. But you know, you go out the solar system, then you've got the Milky Way, then you've got all the galaxies, then you've got the idea of the Big Bang, and you say, well, that's all that is for us. It's a kind of an objectified view of things. Whereas if you're looking at your experience, then the world is somehow not that. It's a certain structure within which we live, where we are able to open things up. This is by saying it's a horizon. The idea of a horizon is very much the analogy, the best analogy to get an idea of it is the horizon of your visual field. It's a fascinating, oh no, you don't have to, but it's very useful to, here I am and I can see both my hands as I look in front of me. I can still see them. Just about. Still a tiny sense of movement. They've gone. I can see them again. Do you see there's a horizon there? It's easier if you're moving something like your hands. There's a horizon there, which is a very strange horizon. There's no, your hands don't disappear into blackness. It's not like you're seeing, oh, here's my visual field, and there's all the blackness around the edge. Yes.
No, I'm
just. Yeah. Oh, you're just checking. Yeah. No, it's useful to move something, because if something's moving, if it stops moving, you might stop seeing it. But if it's actually moving, then you know you can test. There's a horizon there where it's very indistinct, but you can start getting the movement. And then as the hand comes round, oh yeah, I can start to, right. Oh, but it's only when it gets in the where the fovea is, that you actually hit, oh, here's my fingers and all the detail. But the whole field has got all this. I mean, if you look at the retina, it's just a tiny centre where there's a high concentration of rods and cones, where you can see in detail, and everything else is, and you can see it as you do this, terribly vague. You know, and most, I think, of what I'm seeing about my hands there is being kind of filled in by neural guesswork.
Mm.
Do you know, you know their hands. If you put something up there that I had no idea what it was, it would be different. I'd have a much more difficult time telling you what it was. But it's the phenomenon of the horizon, of how that visual field is a kind of an analogy for our whole experience of the world, because there's a horizon of the room itself, and you know, I can open the door, and I open up the horizon of the outside, where all the trucks are parked, and the weather and the rain and all the rest of it. The structure of the world is like this kind of space that I live in, that has all of these possibilities extending out of it. That's how I regard Devon. You know, there's a particular possibility down there of me driving to Devon. I say that because we were down there this week. Or there's a possibility, Heathrow is over there somewhere, right? And there's a plane that will take me to Australia. But it's not like the map of the world where you say, oh yeah, Heathrow's there, Australia's there. Now, the actual world horizon for me, for going to Australia, involves me going, opening the car door, you know, going home, packing the bags, getting on the train, you know, and each thing I do, I open up the world and I get on the train, and then I, you know, I arrive at Heathrow, and I open up the terminal, and I go and check, and I open up the plane experience, and we fly on the plane. You know, that's the world. It's got all of these potentials on the horizon that are openable, upable to me. Nicolette once called it the great dome of experience. Do you know, we think that we all live in the objective world, but each of us really live in our own dome of experience. And who knows how far it can stretch and what's there, because the dome of experience, although Searle isn't going to talk about this, includes our dreams, right? It includes where we go at night. Do you get the sense of the structure of this space in which we live? And it's not just a matter of doors leading to other rooms and in the external world. There are moods that we can get into. Yes, there are inner capacities that we have that I'm now going to start thinking. You know, and I'm going to start remembering. I'm now going to start doing some mathematical calculations. Do you see? There's a whole other set of rooms, if you like, that we would call inward, but really they're just part of the horizon of our possible experience. So the great dome of experience isn't just the outer; it's the inner and the outer combined, because it's always like that, right? Wherever you are thinking, you're still sitting on a chair usually. Do you know that it's not that you suddenly go, I'm in another thinking world. The thinking and your being, in some sense, they're moving between each other. Do you see? There's this horizontal aspect to our experience all the time that we transpose into some. You know, we're like scientists. We project ourselves out of that, and imagine ourselves, you know, like Google, like we're on sat nav. Oh, here I am, on some map of the world. But we never experience the world like we're moving across a map. We always experience the world as if I am the very center of the universe. Yes? And wherever I am, then the horizon of my life and the horizon of the world is opening out from where I am. That's me failing to read the slide, of course. That's not at all what the cell's saying. That's me trying to give you an idea of the sense. So the world is pre-given to us, the waking. So he's particularly, and Hassel sticks with this, he's talking about people who are awake, as in not dreaming. Always somehow practically interested subjects, as the universal field of all actual and possible praxis. That's doing, action. I didn't emphasize that enough, you know, but my going to Australia is a doing, right? As is this class. To live is always to live in certainty of the world. This is quite an important distinction.
I found that quite real, true, how true that is, and that's a very simple statement, but you'll always be like that when you live, and when you die you won't be. He's pointing out a certain
this is what he means by the natural attitude.
It's quite reassuring.
Yes.
It makes me think of the many opportunities that people create for others to not be certain. So I'm thinking of Darren Brown, for example, was a sort of mind-bending, you know, shows and experiences that he creates for people to experience something that they can't be certain of, almost, or where reality is.
I don't know that. Bent.
I'm curious to think back at humanity, like, you know, magicians, you know, there's always been sort of the idea of magic, something that takes away from the certainty of life.
Yes.
I think even before that experience, though, you have a certainty that you have an experience. Like, even if someone's a card trick, you think, oh, I can't believe what that happened. You have
but you will be if you are aware of that idea and concept, but you won't be if you're not. So, you know, sometimes Darren Brown has somebody that is unaware of this trick happening. And, you know, and for them, all of a sudden, really, everything that they thought to be true is no longer certain. Mm.
So just in relation to that, because... what Husserl's saying actually is, would say, no, not everything that you thought to be true or certain becomes uncertain when you experience an illusion. Something that you took to be certain, some part of the world that you took to be certain, becomes uncertain. Because this is quite important for the epoche in a way. So. If you experience a hallucination or you have a visual illusion that's been set up, you can get a sense of, oh my gosh, you can get a kind of a hint that we're constructing reality when it goes wrong. Do you know, when an illusion happens, the one that I like to play with is those things that pop out to be 3D. We get two images on a page, and you cross your eyes, and when they coincide in the right way, suddenly it pops out as if it were a 3D object, and you can feel the space of it. Here it is, it's standing out off the page, and yet you know that there's just two lines on the page, and there's no object there at all. There's a kind of a key in an experience like that that says, oh my God, but that's what we're doing all the time. That I just happened, those two things happened to correspond, and then the space popped out. But in fact, as I look around the room, all of the things that I'm seeing are corresponding in the right way in my eyes, so I'm experiencing the room as popping out into three dimensions. And if someone was messing around with my eyes with, you know, virtual reality, you could turn it back into a two-dimensional image. Although, of course, you get the three dimensions by moving, because as you move, then something in the foreground moves relative to the background. They don't move together. If it was a photograph, you know how they mess around with photographs on TV now. They take a photograph, but then they cut out the foreground figures and put the background behind them, so that when the camera moves over the photograph, it appears that the foreground figures move relative to the background, and you think, I pay attention to this quite a lot. It's in a documentary, often all you've got is a photograph of something, and if you run a camera over a photograph, it's boring. I'm not getting anything new, you know. It's the same photograph, but if you say that was the photograph, what they do is they actually separate, they get the foreground, say there's a person there, and they actually pull them apart like that. And then as the camera moves around, the foreground and the background move relative to each other, just because they've cut the photograph and split it like that. And also filled in a bit of detail that was behind the figure that wasn't in the photograph. And suddenly you get three dimensions from that.
I think it's called a parallax. Parallax something or other. I forgot what, that's the name of the effect.
Yes.
Parallax.
Yes.
Because you have your web pages as well.
Yes.
You're like the background will move slower than the foreground.
Yeah.
Giving you effect of depth.
Yes. And you've suddenly, it has a whole sense of reality for us. But when you see that, you say, oh gosh, it's all manipulated. Maybe my whole experience is kind of an illusion like that. But we don't actually, this is the point, we don't feel that. We feel the illusion only shows itself as an illusion on the background of the certainty that all of the rest of it is real. If we actually had an experience, a deep experience, that the entire thing is some kind of an illusion, it would be extremely disturbing. Whereas if you experience or you have somebody sets up an illusion like a magician, it's entertaining. It's entertaining to have your sense of what's real messed around with, but only a part of it. If you have this, if you have the sense of the entire reality, which means I'm not really me, my mother's not really my mother, my father's not really my father. Do you know, if the whole ground was taken away, you'd fall. It would be like an abyss of a complete loss of orientation. But our orientation in our ordinary lives is that we live in the certainty of the world. We don't. If the magician produces a trick, we don't suddenly think that Boris Johnson isn't the Prime Minister. Do you know there's
hypnosis, which could make you believe that to be.
Yes, but you can mess around with a belief,
mm-hmm.
but within the structure, this bigger structure of the world is absolutely enormous.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, you think, oh, everything's going topsy-turvy because something that you're looking at has become uncertain. But do you see the background structure of the world is still holding it in? You're still able to make sense of it and say it's an illusion. Yes? And the way you're able to make sense of it and say it's an illusion is because the structure of the world and your certainty of it is still operating. Waking life is being awake to the world, being constantly and directly conscious of the world and of oneself as living in the world. Actually experiencing and actually affecting the ontic certainty of the world. Now, the idea that I'm affecting the ontic certainty of the world is the idea that I'm granting it being. But when we live in the certainty of the world, we don't experience it like that at all. We experience ourselves as being just one being in the midst of the world. There's no sense that we, in any sense, that we're granting being to the world. There's the sense of me being a thing in the world. That's our, when we're living in the world, that's our sense. I'm just one human being amongst all of the others. There's in the ordinary natural attitude, there is no sense that, in some sense, I'm affecting, or the granting of the being of the tables and of the chairs. There's no sense that it's coming in some way from me. It's pre-given. The being of everything, I consider pre-given at many, many levels. Right, pre-given as in it was there before I was born, it's going to be there after I die. Pre-given as in I walk out of the room and it's still there. Right? It's deeply in us, this certainty of the being of the things in the world.
But what does Husserl mean there, then, that we're actually affecting the ontic certainty of the world? Because that seems to contradict
the... Yeah, I'm wondering if there should be an A at that beginning of that word instead of me.
No, we're effecting means we are bringing... To effect means to actually bring the certainty of the being of the world is something that we are granting to our experience.
Yeah, I got confused.
Yes? We're granting it. And that, with an illusion, we get a little hint of it because it goes wrong. Yes, yeah, and you, but when Husserl or I say, I am granting it, he's not talking about egoic me. Obviously, I'm not sitting here saying, I better keep granting reality to the computer or it'll disappear. And particularly with like visual illusions, you see that there's nothing that your personal willing can do about it. You know, you can put a stick in water and it's bent. It appears bent. You can't make it look straight by saying, it's just an illusion. Right, the water, it's a straight stick. You're thinking that you can't straighten the stick. Right, the way you perceive things, it's not when Husserl's talking about this affecting that in some way. You are affecting it. He's talking about an absolutely anonymous. I mean, never uses the word power, but power maybe is a word that you can use. Something is affecting this, is granting being. So that something, one name for it is consciousness.
There's any point in bringing mental illness in the discussion, because there can be cases when like people might think that they see things or they hear things which are not
there. Yes.
I guess Husserl did not talk about.
Well, no, he maintained his kind of discussion on normal waking consciousness, of course that can. I mean, when that breaks down for people, then it becomes the sort of sense of disintegration and panic that I was talking about. If your certainty of the world really starts to break down, it's because you're starting to go towards madness in that situation. But even so, I mean, even so, yes.
I guess Alzheimer also would be something where... You know, your structure of the world is really falling apart.
Yes, and it's just hard. I guess the thing for us as phenomenologists is we can only really communicate on this ground of what we would call normal waking consciousness, because that's where we all intersect. And if we start to discuss what schizophrenia might be like. We can't necessarily. We don't have the experience to examine it.
I think it sort of speaks to that, though, with this. But exists a fundamental difference between the way we're conscious of the world and the way we're conscious of things or objects. This is a distinction there, and
Yes.
And yes, so I feel that, like the conjurer, there's an experience that happens before the illusion, and that's what we are. That's what we're certain of. After that, I think you're in the realm of things and objects, and there I think that there probably can be discrepancies. I think he does sort of explore that a little bit.
Well, he's with the
in a way to give things validity.
I'm not sure. My sense, what he's trying to talk about with the. There are the things and the objects in the world that we have access to. When he's pointing to the world and saying that the world isn't an object, the world is the place within which objects appear. Because if we get down to the bottom, he's saying that it would be it would make no sense to think of the world in plural. there just is for us the world. There aren't. I mean, we can think of, if we use the word differently, there's the world of the artists, right? There's the world of the politicians, right? There's the world at Westminster, but he doesn't mean that kind of world. He means the world. And what he's, I think what he's trying to highlight there is that at one level, if we think objectively, what we think of as the world is a kind of collection of everything that is. And he's saying, I don't mean that. I mean it's the horizon within which everything that is appears. It's the structure of the, what did Heidegger call it? I'm looking at Nicolette.
The clearing of being.
The clearing of being. Thank you, Nicolette. Yeah. Yes. The clearing of being. Because there's a certain sense here where the world itself, the horizon of the world itself, is a kind of a correlate of our consciousness. Because there's a point where our consciousness is the space in which everything appears.
But there's no time in it that we know of, is there? I mean, there is time, but like now there's no time when you're just in it. We're just all in it.
Mm.
So there's no time. I mean, there is time probably from the time I can see Anthony, and but not like time in... It's very immediate, isn't it? It's exceedingly immediate.
Yes.
So even if you had a psychosis, which is, you know, like a really, you know, real psychotic, you'd still maybe wouldn't see the door quite the way I'm seeing the door, but... You'd still be here, wouldn't you? I'm like, it's hard to get in someone's world like that, but it's all like now, it's all now, isn't it? It's all like...
Yes.
There isn't time in it. Well, there is time in it, but there isn't somehow.
I mean,
you're
I guess...
You're not coming in and saying, oh, well, it's all like this. It's just, it is.
Well, time is another... interesting question, because
because you'd still be giving, if you're in a psychotic state, you'd still be giving that you'd still have that psychosis, whatever was going on.
Yes.
It would still be there. You'd still be lit here, even if someone told you that, you wouldn't be able to maybe comprehend what you're talking about.
But if I can give
but in the big thing of it all, you'd still be in that psychosis, wouldn't you?
If I can give a sort of a kind of a model, it's a scientific model, because we were talking about hallucinations and mental illness. The picture that I have from, you know, my own studies is that in effect what the brain is doing is it's attempting to predict that what's coming up as input through the senses, and what we would call normal waking life is that what our brains are predicting pretty much agrees with what's coming in through the senses, and because we agree, and what's coming in through the senses is in a certain sense objective, the same for all of us, and so long as we stick with that, we end up in an agreement together, because we're all sampling the same data. And we're all making successfully predicting what's coming in. So we agree there's a phone, we agree there are tables, we agree about what I'm talking about. And I guess the more recent understandings of schizophrenia and psychosis are that what's being predicted no longer corresponds with what the senses are informing us about, so you really do go off into another world in that sense. You're no longer part of this kind of unified intersubjective world, and I think that's what Husserl's talking about, that we're in a certain agreement about the world being the same for us, which comes from our brains have to work properly for that to happen, which means they have to just be in touch. Do you know, they have to correspond with what's going on in the senses.
But then the whole whole other worlds that we want and allow to come into that, what we call entertainment, is often something that is completely outside of our normal horizon, right? So you watch an American film, there's all these things, and I have to think, well, that doesn't happen in my life, and it only seems to happen in the film. But there's a whole, and also having a drink or something, we're forcing something slightly different onto the world at the time.
Yes.
And there seems to be a real human curiosity about that.
Yeah.
About the
difference. Well, yeah, because we could say also, like, science fiction and the whole idea of space and time, when you start going off into the other galaxies too, that's something, as John was saying, that we're not experiencing, but we're sort of accepting it within the horizon.
And what you mentioned also, films, so, you know, perhaps some people haven't got an experience of, you know, they grew up without parents, or to bring the counselling and stuff into it, but so I find it interesting in that context, like, you know, so somebody might grow up without two loving parents, and then they watch movies, and their idea of what love and relationship is built on those movies rather than on the reality of what it is to be in a relationship, you know, man and woman, man and man, whatever. But, you know, sort of these things that are not facts, but they're maybe part of our structure of our world, and with, you know, they can be based on something that's not real. If you haven't got that, the reality in your life, you might seek to find that in, you know, in the outside, in movies, etc., books.
You have a reality, look at an Instagram and make believe life.
Yeah, but I guess, yeah, perhaps, like, I mean, the structure, so how do you build that structure, really, you know? What your structure of the world?
It has to be based on your own surface and your own, and because, you know, that's what I was thinking about, the bliss of ignorance. It's, we can only afford being that when we have a strong foundation, strong ground. Otherwise, all your projections make great illusion.
So, just to pull us back to Husserl, he limited himself pretty much to the discussion of the perception of things on the table, if you like, because to avoid, in a way, going into this. You know, the further we get away from the things on the table, the more we differ. And it's the dear old human race, that's probably that's as good as we've managed it, isn't it? We can just about agree on cups and tables and chairs. And as we move further away into the realms of what we think about each other, what we think about our culture, you know, what we think is going on in the world, what we think about our parents, what we think about what the cause of our feelings, you know, how our feelings affect what we think's going on. We, as pretty much as soon as we leave the cups and tables and chairs, we start to differ. And that's partly, I think, why Husserl kind of says, well, we have to start with where we do actually manage to function. If you can't function with tables and chairs, then that's, you start ending up in seeing a doctor. You know, we've got a kind of a small area where we do function factually, and that's pretty much the ordinary everyday perception of objects. So he tends to stay there because.
So also that's his experience as well. He's probably only told about things that he can't directly experience.
Yes.
Like, you know, schizophrenia.
Yes.
I'm not sure if it sort of was schizophrenic, but. Be quite difficult for him to do the reduction and to sort of write from a point of experience. When he, you know, when he's not actually a schizophrenic.
Yes.
So how can you possibly know if he wrote to be a schizophrenic?
Yes.
But even if you're a schizophrenic, you'd still be, like my uncle was schizophrenic, and he was walking in the hills in the south of France, you know, and he was still experiencing the world, wasn't he? Even if I wouldn't know what that would be like.
I just use that as a sort
you know,
of...
you're still having an immediate, I mean, a schizophrenic would still be having an immediate, even if they're believing that baby Jesus is about to be born and to him and all that sort of thing. He's still having it. He's still living
it, right.
In the certainty of the world, even though he's believing that he's lost the plot completely and he's wandering the hills and he thinks his son is going to be baby Jesus at Christmas. He's still there, isn't he? I mean,
there's an intersection.
I mean,
he may be
having a different. I can't know
yes.
what Uncle John had, but you know, like it would be. You'd still have a. A schizophrenic generally, or I don't want to call them a schizophrenic like that, but for someone suffering from that thing would most likely be able to sit on a chair or...
But the, the picture I have of it is that there are degrees. It's like the mind's projecting can be an idea like that Sean's going to be baby Jesus
yeah.
and the hills and everything that we're walking on are still the same. But that can expand and expand and expand until you completely lose all touch with where you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know
yeah.
it's a matter of degree. It is quite possible just leave any sense of the room and everything. I mean,
yeah.
human consciousness does that in dreams, right?
Yeah.
So it's all, do you know, it starts like that, but it can spread and
yeah.
become a complete disconnect. Yes, I see what I know. What you mean? You don't.
Some universal thing. That
yes.
I can't. They're not because we don't all think about a one living in the world. We don't think like that.
No, because we don't recognize the world because we, as a structure or a horizon, we live in, because we're too busy. Dealing with all of the objects. Things, objects are given as being valid for us in each case, but in principle only in such a way that we are conscious of them as things or objects within the world horizon. Each one is something of the world of which we are constantly conscious as horizon. It's interesting. I guess one way, because he's talking about the waking world, so it's interesting to contrast that with the dream and how easy it is for us to actually dream, and that the most unusual and absurd things happen in dreams, don't they? And it's quite bizarre. I often wake up and think, I'm in the dream, I didn't go, what? You've got to be kidding, you know, that can't happen. Yeah, no, we just, yeah, oh, that's all right, it's all right with me.
It's almost like sort of there's a unconscious part that goes like, yeah, okay, so you try to make sense of things out in the real world, but I'm going to meddle all that up inside your head. Do you know? It's like as if it's almost like sort of holding that not making sense of the world.
But there's still things show up, people and objects show up. And yet, all of them.
The meaning is different.
Yes, there's all kinds of impossibilities. But I mean, what surprises me when I wake up is the impossibilities didn't even cause a hiccup. it's very, very strange.
What I noticed personally, the less logical and controlled my life is when I'm awake, the more. The logical my dreams are, and vice versa.
Yes.
Yeah, this is what I find fascinating.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's dear old, you know, Dr. Jung. He says that's his, you know, his main, one of the main things is that the unconscious is always compensating. So it'll, if you're too one way, it'll go the other. Trying to pull you back, dear old. Unless you ignore it, then it starts.
And this is the way to measure it, combining the both.
Yeah.
And see the outcome.
Yes. All right, the last, coming down the bottom, every object has its possible varying modes of being valid, the modalizations of ontic certainty. By that, he means absolutely actual. My car, I'm pretty certain it's there, yes? Things can move from degrees of certainty to probability to possibility, to the point of something like dark energy. You know, dark energy is the existence of dark energy, unless you just kind of suck it up out of the documentaries. It's, you know, the universe is flying apart and accelerating. This is the latest observations of it, is that it's not just flying apart, but it's getting faster and faster. The theories to explain how gravity works didn't predict that. So some mathematician basically said, well, there must be more matter and there must be more energy in the universe than we thought. And so I'll just put that into my equations. And if there's that amount of matter and energy that we know nothing about, that would explain the expansion of the universe. Therefore, there is dark matter, even though nobody's observed it. Even the possibility of observing it is questionable. That's a kind of an example of something that we exist, that we think of as existing. I mean, I watch it with interest on the TV. On the news the other night, there was a piece on dark energy, and there was just no doubt that it's there. You know, it's just a variable in a mathematical equation that's been projected. It's been given existence by people who don't really know the science, and everybody's not everybody, but. It's kind of a nice idea. There's all of this other energy and other matter in the universe. You know, 80% was it? But we only know a tiny bit. It's a very appealing kind of poetic idea, but it's in terms of how certain could we be that it's real, hardly any certainty in it whatsoever. So do you see everything's on a kind of a scale in our world, especially if you live in media world? Do you know there are things there that probably never happened that have been reported. Yes.
Modes of validity are different from levels of doubt.
Let me think. Yes. Because there's another dimension where you remember something, say. So, and it's not. You're not quite. You're not. You could think of that everything has a level of doubt.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like your car being over there.
Yeah, but there are different modes of existence that you can think of things in terms of their being. I can think of my mother, right? Who isn't alive anymore. That's a different mode of being.
Mm.
That I grant to her.
Yeah.
A having been.
Yeah.
But being no more. You see, so it's not just like modes of doubt.
Yeah.
There's different modes of being in that way.
Yeah.
Or I can picture a future life that I fully intend to live, or I can picture something I'm going to build.
Yeah.
And I can be certain that I'm going to build it. You know, very certain
mm.
that it's going to happen. I'm going to make that thing, but it doesn't exist yet. So do you see, there are multiple modes, not just I'm doubtful about whether something actually exists now. You've got the future and the past
mm.
in your imagination, so you were granting modes of being in many dimensions.
Yeah.
The world, on the other hand, does not exist as an entity, as an object, but exists with such uniqueness that the plural makes no sense when applied to it. Every plural and every singular drawn from it presupposes the world horizon. See, there's a sense that, and I think he's going to say it later, that the world and the consciousness that constitutes the world, they're kind of, they're together. There's a sort of a sense where the world is a kind of a, the world for us, the structure of the world for us is a kind of a, it's like consciousness itself. You could say two sentences like, the world is the space in which everything appears. And you could equally well say, consciousness is the space where everything appears. Do you see the two are kind of, there in some sense there's a unity between them. Quick pass through the natural attitude, because I can feel, you know, there's a certain kind of need for a tea break coming up, isn't there? What do you say? Not bothered. Well, the first way in which waking life is carried on, the naturally normal one, which absolutely must precede the others, not for accidental but for essential reasons, is that of straightforwardly living toward whatever objects are given, thus toward the world horizon, in normal unbroken constancy, in a synthetic coherence running through all acts. Does that mean anything to you, the synthetic coherence running through all acts? There's a unity to conscious experience. Somehow or other, it's all of a piece. I mean, if you think about it, reflect on it, there's all this stuff happening. You know, there's the feeling in my thigh, there's the thought going through my head, there's what I'm seeing, I'm flicking my eye here, I'm flicking my eye there, I'm flicking my eye there, there's my sense I'm in the middle of a lecture. There's all kinds of what Husserl would call intentionalities, all kind of operating in me. Some of them half asleep, about to become awake again, and yet the whole thing is in a flowing unity. And it's not as if anything ever really stops. It just kind of, it's like it fades out like at the edge of the visual field. Do you know, things do stop, but they don't sort of stop dead. They just kind of fade out, and the next thing occurs, and there's no sense of the biggest discontinuity, I think. I mean, we do experience a kind of getting lost in thought, and then suddenly say, oh gosh, here I am. You know, you might, maybe when you're driving that can happen. You suddenly, I'm here. But even then, it's all part of this stream. The biggest break for us, I guess, is going to sleep. But going to sleep and waking up is again, I keep thinking of the, do you know, it's all the structure of the horizon of the waking life has its little waking up and going to sleep at night, just the same as the edge of the, you know, you're going to sleep is like the hand disappearing off the edge of the visual field. It gets so vague as you go to sleep, you're not conscious of what's happening, right? You actually go into the periphery and then disappear. And the same when you wake up, you can feel you're coming in to clarity out of what? Well, you can't say because you weren't conscious there. I mean, sometimes there's a dream left. But I do remember once waking up in Australia where I'd been awake, it seemed to me, for a while with my eyes shut. And then the air conditioning came. It had been on all the time. But it's like my my hearing had been asleep. I'd woken up, but my ears hadn't. And suddenly my ears woke up, and the air conditioning unit goes shh, you know, because it makes a noise. And I thought, oh gosh, yeah, you can even wake, different senses can wake up at different times. But that was very interesting, because I was awake enough to experience my hearing waking up. It was a lot of those things. I mean, you can get that if you fly as well, where you wake up and you don't know where you are. You know, you've lost what country you're in. You don't know what room you're in. The whole thing's gone. That's another experience where the world hasn't quite, you know, that it hasn't quite formed its structure around you, which is where that's part of the structure of the world, you see, and this synthetic coherence is when you wake up, you suddenly plug yourself into the narrative of yesterday, and yesterday's connected to the whole darn story, right? There's a while there when you wake up where yesterday hasn't. I mean, it's tragic, isn't it? Especially if yesterday was a, if you're it can be. If you're in a particularly difficult part of your life, and you've actually just got out of it because you fell asleep, and you wake up and you have to remember, there's a moment there where you sort of realise, but I'm free. Obviously, I'm free because I was able to leave it, right? Often that sleep-wake transition gives you a kind of a glimpse of what he's talking about by the waking world. Because it has to almost reconstitute itself every morning. But usually we're in such a habit, we don't, you know, it's back. Where am I? This normal, straightforward living towards whatever objects are given indicates that all of our interests have their goals in objects. He's talking about the project of our lives, right? Like the project this morning to come to this class, having dinner, what am I going to watch on TV if you do watch TV, my job, my relationships. There's a kind of living where that's it, right? That living toward the objects of the world is your life. That's what, if you like, consumes your waking consciousness, is the activities of your life. Because doing phenomenology is sort of taking a break from that. That's the intention of the epoche. If you're taking a break from living toward the whatever it is that you're living toward, because we're each doing different things here, aren't we? Do you have a sense of the project of your life? No? Yeah, no, there's not. Yeah. I mean, in a way, it can break down. You know, I remembered I was living in Brighton when I was much younger. And it did sort of broke down for me. I'd get up in the morning and I'd think, well, why? You know, I've got to eat, right? I'm hungry, but you know, I'll read a book, but why, you know, I think I'll go down the pub and have a pint, but why?
Back to bed.
Yes.
Babies or young children go through that phase too.
Do they?
The why phase.
Yes. But I wasn't really, I wasn't actually expecting an answer.
Yeah.
I just lost any kind of any interest. I wasn't getting the feedback, you know, which when you're engaged in the project of your life, you get a kind of a, there's something in you that wants to do it. That's partly what he's talking about, that being that I want to do it. I want to live in a way. It's a kind of a wanting to live. which I'm sure, you know, in a way will kick in very strongly if we were living much more if we were living life where getting food was an issue.
We should have time for reflection.
Yeah, yeah. Where today the main thing is to be able to get enough food for the evening meal. Right? So I'm going to go out hunting today because I'm hungry. Do you know, that would be an example where, and I was, you know, me and Brian was a kind of an extreme example of you took the animal out of nature. You put it in a room, you gave it enough money and food so it doesn't need to do anything, and then it just doesn't know what to do. But if you put our little creatures back into a world like that, then we just naturally get on with it.
Well, I guess we had the luxury of being able to have thoughts about meaning once we didn't have to fight for our survival every waking minute. And now it's almost as if it's taken away too much from us, so that we're lacking meaning. So now we had meaning, in a way, or found meaning, and now things become meaningless, because we just have so much time and the luxury to just, I don't know, consume rather than think, it seems, as a sort of society.
Yes.
But we are also not having to hunt for our survival, or we don't have to think about our survival in certain parts of the world. So it's almost as if it feels like if it was healthy to have to fight for survival again. Do you know, like kind of reboot?
Of course, you're
so risky. Risky territory.
Yes.
You're reminding me though that of course if we look into it, any of these surviving cultures that will live much closer to the earth, they didn't live like that, where what's the meaning of your life is to get food and eat and survive.
Mm-hmm.
They all more or less uniformly had some idea of some greater purpose to their being on the earth. So that in a way contradicts things for me, what I was saying.
And yeah. I think there was in fact some sort of pure wisdom.
Yes. 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 I'm reminded of Jung saying that I think one of the Native American Indians that he was in contact with, their culture was that it was their purpose was to in some sense acknowledge the sun, because if they didn't acknowledge the sun wouldn't rise, and they actually felt that if it was up to them, particularly when the white man came, because the white man wasn't going to make the sun rise. The white man just thought that it was just some kind of rock or burning thing in the sky. Didn't understand if it wasn't for us, the sun wouldn't rise. And although we may smile at that. That's a terribly important meaning to the life, because Jung was struggling with that. What meaning is left to us when you chop and chop and chop and chop away with objective science? I'm just while we're on this subject. He came up with a sense of why are we here? Why is the human race here? Particularly the human race, because it seems that throughout our history we haven't been satisfied with what I just said. I'm here to get the supper. As soon as we recognise, so consciously recognise that there is death, we the next question is, well, what's it all about?
Water.
Yes, yeah. What's it all about? Jung's answer, which I think you have to experience really, is we're here to just to be conscious of the earth. That's a, our role here is to be conscious of the earth, of its beauty. Really, our role, we've come here so that nature, if you like, can know itself. And the experience of nature knowing itself is an experience of wonder, if you like. That's in a way I reckon that's good, because it doesn't say we're here to create some kind of utopia on earth, and you know, nationalize the post office and everything will be fine. It's got a kind of a, we're not actually here to do anything, but to actually see the blackbird. You see, the blackbird isn't able to see like we do. That's our role, is to the blackbird sings, but it's almost that we're required to hear the song. No other animal on earth can hear the song of the blackbird in the way that we do. We hear the song of the blackbird and we know what it is. It's a kind of it's an extraordinary event that there are beings here it's not just, we hear it and we know what it is, and we in some sense register the sweetness of it. Do you know, that's why we're here. It's not a bad. It's not bad, is it? It's not bad. You don't have to work towards anything there. You just have to go and, you know. I mean, of course, the next step is you go, oh no, look what we're doing to the earth, you know. And you start thinking about that. But you've still got to hear the blackbird while he's here, do you know. He's still here. That would be the... Shall we have a... Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.